Thank you. Be seated. The court is ready to hear argument from petitioner in Humble Sand and Gravel versus Gomez.
May it please the court, Mr. Michael Young is an argument for petitioner. The petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
May it please the court. The intermediary and sophisticated user doctrines are well established in Texas. This case presents an opportunity for this court to consider how those doctrines work in tandem as applied to a product supplied exclusively for use by industrial employees. The case is particularly suitable for that inquiry for several reasons. First, it involves silicon, a product whose risks have been known literally for centuries. With the means of avoidance of those risks known literally for decades. It involves a particularly rich record establishing such widespread knowledge in the abrasive blasting industry. It involves an extensive and detailed regulatory scheme placing duties on employers to warn and protect their workers against those risks. And finally, it involves a product supplied exclusively to industrial users. Now, the Court of Appeals recognized the potential combination of these doctrines, but then subjected that combination to so many artificial and seemingly absolute constraints that it collapsed under the weight of those constraints. We believe this was inappropriate. The restatement of torts states that there is no general categorical rule as to when it is permissible for a supplier to rely on an intermediary to warn or protect the ultimate consumer, that the test is one of reasonableness under the circumstances.
Mr. Young, a lot of the cases that have been cited and looked at seem to begin with, they identify the question, is the duty to warn the employee? They then determine, under any different scenarios, that there was no duty, not that there wasn't a duty to warn the employee, but the duty had been discharged by the warning to the employer, who was reasonably understood to be a conduit for the warning. There appeared to be a couple of cases where judges talked in, where the judges wrote in terms, well, they didn't differentiate between the reasonable conduit of the warning and the failure to warn the employer. But is there a case that, accepting all you have said is true, is there a case out there from any state Supreme Court or the U.S. Supreme Court that absolves the manufacturer of an admittedly toxic product from giving an adequate warning to the buyer, in this case the employer?
The courts that follow the so-called duty approach do exactly that. They say that where there is an intermediary, the duty is to give the intermediary such warnings, if any, as may be necessary. And there is no duty to warn the employee. That would be the Washington case from the Fifth Circuit, which was the shop vac case. There are several others. That's the so-called duty approach.
Why is there a duty imposed in those circumstances? What's the reasoning behind it?
The reasoning behind the duty approach, Your Honor?
Well, I mean, you've got the premise, I think, is that you have the learned intermediary who's going to evaluate the dangers, and there is a very special relationship between the two. And we recognize that in the physician-patient context, because of the closeness of that relationship, which just is not present in an employer-employee situation.
Well, Your Honor, I think it is in most important and meaningful ways. First of all, the employer, like the physician, is under a duty to the employee or the patient. Second, the physician has a unique ability that the drug manufacturer doesn't have to know what that patient's needs are, to know what that patient, both medical needs and informational needs.
Exactly. The focus is on the patient and the patient's well-being. And I'm not sure you can say an employer's primary concern is with the safety of their employee. Their primary concern is with the utility of the product.
Well, that is true, Your Honor, but the employer has not only general duties to train, warn, and protect, but very specific duties. And he's charged both by common law and by the OSHA regulations with maintaining a safe workplace. And in the case of abrasive blasting with silica, has pages and pages of very detailed information about what he must communicate and what he must do to protect the worker. He has the ability to know how that product is going to be used in his factory. The supplier does not. He has the ability to know the linguistic capability, the educational background, the intelligence level of a particular employee. He has the ability to communicate with that employee, not only through a written warning, but orally, through questions and answers, through demonstrations, through practice, through ongoing training. And he has the ability to follow through. He can fire the worker if the worker doesn't wear his air-fed hood. Same supplier cannot.
What are the limits of the application of the learned intermediary defense in the products liability context, if you say it should be applied there?
The limits are this. Under the restatement test and the mixed duty restatement test, it must be reasonable for the supplier to rely on the intermediary to warn or protect the worker. It is not necessarily reasonable in every industry and every product.
Well, but I'm not quite sure in application what that limit would be. I mean, would an automobile manufacturer then say that the local dealer knows all about the car and I told them all about it, therefore I have no responsibility for the product? For example, I mean, I understand that that's a test, but in application, if it applies in that way, it seems to me it has very broad application in the product liability context, and I'm not sure what the limits would be.
Well, I mean, one limit is that the dealer does not have a duty above and beyond the duty the manufacturer has to warn his customers. He has the same generalized duty of warning that the manufacturer has.
But he can see the customer, knows them better. It's right there in the community, knows if this is in Alaska or Honduras, what the use is going to be.
Well, but not in a substantially more detailed way than the manufacturer does. General Motors knows how cars are driven in Alaska in a way different from the way Humble Sand does not know how Spincoat operates its blasting facility, how somebody else operates theirs, and so on. There is a differential there in the degree of knowledge. The additional factor is whether it is reasonable to expect that the intermediary will warn or protect. And so that would, you know, if the testimony were that the automobile dealer industry knows full well and is fully equipped to protect his customers against risk X, then you might have a potential case for application of that doctrine.
The dealer is selling to the customer, right?
That's correct.
And already has a duty to warn.
Has a generalized duty to warn.
So, but the employer's not selling to the employee.
No, that's correct. But he has a broader duty to warn than the dealer does because the feds have said so. A broader and more detailed duty. I think that's the key part.
You said under the duty approach, going back to my question, under the duty approach, there's this duty to warn at least somebody, and in this case it would be the employer.
Right.
I was looking for a state Supreme Court case or a U.S. Supreme Court case that said in this circumstance, a very knowledgeable employer in this business, that there wasn't at least the threshold that the manufacturer had no duty to warn to begin with.
To warn anyone?
To warn anyone.
I am not aware of any case that says that. I'm not aware of any case that says, that combines the principle that there's no duty to warn of dangers commonly known by the class of purchasers and the doctrine that one may rely on an intermediary to warn.
Does the restatement presuppose that Humble has given a warning to Spincoat and that the real issue is whether or not Humble was reasonable in relying on Spincoat to convey that warning to the employee? Or are you saying that your position, the restatement, would say that if I know I'm dealing with Spincoat, who knows all this stuff, I have no duty to warn Spincoat of these dangers, and I'm also reasonable in relying on Spincoat to do all these warnings anyway?
the restatement supposes that the supplier will give the intermediary such warning as is necessary, if any. Then, in turn, we apply this court's decision in Sauter and say, all right, was a warning to SpinCo necessary? And the answer is yes, but only if the ordinary class of SpinCos of the world, the abrasive blasting employers, would not have the information that the warning would convey. And the evidence was very copious in this record that the abrasive blasting industry knew the things that it is said that Humble should have told them.
Is that a duty question, or is that a breach of duty? I mean, is my duty to warn limited by the knowledge already held by the buyer, or is that simply sort of a producing cause notion that I may have failed to warn, but it didn't produce their damages because they already knew?
The answer is both. As to the subjective knowledge of the buyer, it is a producing cause question. As to the knowledge of the general class of buyers, this court held in Sauter versus Boyd that if the general class of buyers already has the information, there is simply no duty to warn. So the objective part of the test goes to the duty question. The subjective part of the test goes to the producing cause question.
Would this same defense apply in the asbestos context?
It might or it might not. We don't have the record in this case as to what the asbestos industry knew and when it knew it. However, from what we know generally, the knowledge of the dangers of asbestos is much more recent and much less widespread than the knowledge of the dangers of silica. Back in the 1700s,
But arguably, if there is evidence in an asbestos case that an asbestos manufacturer given the state of knowledge that a manufacturer may have had at that point in time, why wouldn't that be enough to trigger the learned intermediary defense in terms of being able to pass warnings along to a supplier and rely upon it?
If a particular asbestos-using industry were shown to have widespread knowledge of the risks that allegedly should be communicated, then that case would be eligible, at least, for the intermediary sophisticated user defense.
And so the defense would be an absolute protection to the asbestos manufacturer in that context?
Well, it would depend on
if they prevailed on it.
It would depend on whether this court said that the reasonableness of the reliance is a duty question for the court or a disputed factual issue, which is a predicate to a duty question, as in Union Pacific versus Williams, for the jury. But if the latter, then the asbestos supplier would have to convince the jury that it was reasonable for them to rely on this particular asbestos-using industry to warn and protect workers.
And if they did, then they would be off the hook.
If they did, then they would be off the hook.
You say that there's no duty if the general class of buyers knows the risk.
That's
okay,
correct.
So the manufacturer would have no obligation then to warn, even if the product it's supplying, you know, say company X, if that company is known to be negligent consistently in failing to protect its employees from the risk associated with that product.
Known by the seller, Your Honor?
Yeah, let's say general, known by the seller. It's just a grossly negligent company.
That's an interesting question arising out of Sauter. I don't know how this court would have decided Sauter if the supplier of the O-rings had known in point of fact that Mr. Boyd was not aware of the danger, even though the run-of-the-mill user was aware. I would say on the product side, that's probably still no duty because the product is designed and supplied for the global class of users. There might be a different result on the negligence side. I don't think this court has ever faced the question where there is objective knowledge within the industry, but no subjective knowledge on the part of the particular plaintiff or the particular intermediary. So I don't know what the answer to that question
is. Does the restatement third change the analysis at all?
It really doesn't. It says roughly the same thing in different words. Section 2, I believe it's comment J, echoes 388 comment N.
Can you tell me the public policy behind adopting it in this context?
Yes, Your Honor. There are really two public comments.
Well, let me premise my question. If it's foreseeable that the product is going to be used by the employee directly, and a warning is pretty easy to do, what is the public policy of absolving the employer, of absolving the manufacturer based on a presumption that the employer will protect its employee?
There are two public policies, Ron. First of all, it is not always the case that a warning is feasible, even if there's something to place it on.
Presuming it is. I think you've conceded in this case it is.
Well, it is and it isn't, because bags, products in bags get removed from bags. And the evidence shows that Mr. Gomez happened to be charged by his employer with unloading the freight cars, and so he happened to see the bags, but then the bags are dumped into hoppers, and nobody ever sees the bags again after that. So my first point is, feasibility is not an on or off kind of thing. It may be partially feasible, but not totally feasible. But beyond that, there are really two public policies. One is so-called information cost. The more warnings you put on something, the more you diminish the impact of each and every one of them.
In this case, there's not, I mean, the information cost is negligible. Well, in fact, the company did change the warning.
We did change the warning, but I'm not sure that the information cost was negligible. Mr. Gomez said that the more detailed warning would have convinced him to quit that job and go into another line of work. Unless we want, as a matter of policy, for all abrasive blasting workers to quit their jobs, that policy is not fulfilled by putting that warning on there.
We're talking about feasibility of the warning. And are you saying it would not be feasible to put the more detailed warning in this case? I thought that was pretty much a given, that
we
in this case it was not a difficult thing to do, and you in fact did it.
We did it in 93. It would have induced Mr. Gomez to quit his job, he says.
What does that have to do with the feasibility of placing the warning, what he would or would not have done?
Because the point of the warning is not, we weren't at fault for not conveying a message to quit his job. Because the testimony is that abrasive blasting materials can be used safely with proper protection.
Well, you're on kind of shaky ground there, aren't you? I mean, the public policy would be, if that information would have been induced that, maybe he should have known that. Maybe we ought to err on the side of giving, requiring more information so that he can make that assessment himself.
My point is that to convey the balanced information that needed to be conveyed under the plaintiff's theory of the case would have required more warning even than we gave in the 93 warning and would not have been feasible.
But I think you meet yourself coming around, because you're saying you're relying on the intermediary to give him detailed warnings, which I assume would make him quit his job as well. So, I mean, it doesn't seem consistent.
No. Our premise is that he didn't need to quit his job. The evidence shows that he didn't. He could have used the product safely. And we were relying on the intermediary to give him the information that he needed, as well as the equipment that he needed and the training he needed, to use the product safely. To convey the same kind of information that the intermediary could have conveyed, the balanced message that you can use this product safely, but only if you do it the right way, would not have been entirely feasible.
Okay.
Yes, we could have put something on the bag.
So you had a couple of reasons you were telling me.
The second reason is sort of a law and economics reason, and it's the placing of tort liability on the party best able to preclude the accident. And in this case, that was the employer. We have the complication of the workers' compensation system, which renders the use of tort liability to incentivize employers problematic, but you still have the instance of non-subscribing employers. You still have the instance that, at least on an industry-wide basis and sometime on an individual employer basis, that premiums reflect claim histories. And so placing tort responsibility on the employer.
What about if the warning to the employer is insufficient?
If the warning to the employer is insufficient, then there is liability.
Okay, now what about the technical data sheets in this case? Didn't the manufacturer fail to warn that reusing the silica dust or the silica caused additional problems?
Well, yeah, there was no warning about that, but the federal regulations specifically deal with the recycling of used abrasive material and the way that can be done safely. So if those regulations had been followed, that would not have been an issue.
Any other questions? Thank you, counsel. Court is ready to hear argument from respondent.
May it please the Court, Mr. Stephen Sussman will present argument for the respondent.
Mr. Young has said that this case involves a particularly rich record, and it does. Because it does, you need to look at the facts of this case, not philosophy. The undisputed facts of this case and the facts resolved against Holmberg by the jury are listed on chart A, which I have passed to the court. The first bullet point says it is well known that many sandblasting companies did not protect their employees and violated OSHA. This was established by studies made throughout the 1970s, and Humble, assumed as a manufacturer of a highly dangerous product, is considered to be an expert that should have known of these studies. There was testimony by other sandblasting companies in this case that they were aware of these studies.
Would it make a difference if there were only a few?
Absolutely. I mean, this is the case. They did just ignore this fact throughout all their briefing, that you can use an objective standard, any standard you want. Part of the objective standard is that everyone knew that everyone was not taking precautions, was cutting corners, and was likely to violate OSHA. Second fact, Humble did not fully inform Spinco of the dangers and precautions. Now, Humble says that this was disputed, and that the jury did not resolve this dispute. They're just wrong. Question number one does not refer to any specific warning to any specific person. It could refer to Humble's warnings to Spinco in the material data sheet or the technical fact sheet, or it could refer to Humble's warnings to Spinco employees on the bags, or it could refer to both. This court must construe the answer to question number one, in a way to support the verdict, i.e., that the jury found that all warnings given by Humble were inadequate, whether given to the intermediary or to the intermediary's employees. Question number two, which would support the judgment if you threw out the answer to question number one, is a broad negligence question. It doesn't refer to any warning. And the jury's answer to that would support the judgment. Bullet point two, Humble did not know that Spinco was careful, undisputed. Humble made no effort to find out if Spinco was careful, undisputed. Spinco made the same mistakes that Humble should have known other employees were making, undisputed. Use of flint and sandblasting is extremely hazardous, undisputed. The warning that Humble's put on his bags in 93 was based on information known to it in 1982. You're right, Justice Neal, no additional burden for putting a better warning on the bag. And the 1982 warning was inadequate.
Let me get the context clear here. You're not arguing that learned intermediaries should be restricted to the position.
Absolutely not.
I mean, it's fact-intensive.
Absolutely.
At least by industry.
Yes.
Maybe more than
I am that. Saying that in a given case, even in this industry, even where you have a product sold not in bulk, but in a bag, it might be reasonable for the supplier to rely on the intermediary. Not here. I mean, if the supplier here had gone out and checked on the safety programs at Spinco, knew something about Spinco's character.
How would you do that?
Easy. You say, would you please send me your written instruction manual?
And they say no.
I'm not going to sell you my product. Or, if I sell you my product, I'm going to write something that you have to agree to post in your place for the benefit of your employees. I mean, it would have been easy to find out whether Spinco had a decent safety program. Again, we do not contend, nor did the court below hold, that these doctrines should never relieve a manufacturer of flint sold in bags rather than bulk from the duty to warn employees, and the court doesn't have to extend or refuse to extend any doctrines in this case.
Humble should have three or four different levels of bag warning then, evaluated purchasers.
No, I think the bag warning should be a single warning, but should be the best warning possible. I mean, because it's no additional cost to use the best warning possible on the back.
But if they don't, there might not be liability to some purchasers.
That's
there,
right.
The users of some
purchasers. That's their choice. Their choice.
So you wouldn't make a purchaser-by-purchaser inquiry. You would not say, well, if the industry as a whole generally follows OSHA regulations and generally conducts their business in a safe manner, Humble would still have to look purchaser-by-purchaser to make
sure. I'm not sure. If there were evidence in the record that everyone's following the regulations.
Or generally following.
And there were very few. I mean, all the sandblasting companies, there were very few safety violations on the part of sandblasting companies. That would present a different case. That's not this case.
I'm just trying to find out where you are on the spectrum.
I'm saying you've got to look at that. Maybe in that case. You know, see, in this case, what makes it so, it's so easy to put a different warning on the back. And what we know, because of the principles, everyone agrees that there are two things that control this case. The principles from comment N to the restatement of torts, section 388. And I've given you that in chart 50, it's all quoted and highlighted what's important. But we know under the restatement, for example, that even giving to a third party all the information necessary for safe use is not always sufficient. If you, for example, know that the third party is negligent, or you make no effort to find out whether the third party is careful. Always a question of reasonable assurance. It may be improper to trust the conveyance of necessary information to a third person of whose character he knows nothing. If the danger is very great, the supplier does not exercise reasonable care by entrusting the communication to a third party, even to a person whom he has a good reason for.
Mr. Sussman, do you? I may not articulate the question very well, but do you agree that if a manufacturer of a toxic product sells to a sophisticated buyer, for lack of a better term, the buyer knows as much about the dangers of this product as the manufacturer does, and the buyer is going to be using it in their process with employees, do you agree that the restatement eliminates any duty on the manufacturer's part to warn the buyer?
No. It clearly doesn't. It says that even if the third person knows all the information necessary, and after this is even clearer in this court's decision in Ong, which followed this, and that's in chart C where I quoted from the court in Ong, and you can see that the exact the law of the next, a manufacturer may assert the mere presence of an intermediary does not excuse the manufacturer from warning those whom it should reasonably expect. This is the issue in every case. And you've got to consider all these factors. And negligence on the part of the intermediary does not relieve the supplier of responsibility or its failure to warn. And the restatement coming in says that even if you deal with an intermediary who has perfect knowledge, either because he got explicit warnings from the supplier or because he's just a genius and he's read all the literature, even in that case, it may be unreasonable to rely on the intermediary to pass the information on to the employee.
You think Ong was rightly decided?
Hmm?
Was Ong correctly decided?
I think so.
The
court considered it as a bulk supplier case because it was difficult for the manufacturer of the bottling machine. How are you going to put a warning? So they considered it as a bulk supplier case. Now, if they can't bring themselves within harm, they certainly cannot bring themselves within a case that involves sale of bags where a warning is very feasible.
But this warning that was feasible was, be very careful, this is very dangerous stuff, follow regs, don't deviate.
It can cause
anything. But they didn't tell them what the regs said, which is wear these kinds of hoods, do this kind of stuff. You couldn't put all that on that.
No, you could put on it can cause your death. That's what Gomez testified. Had he known that, he would have quit working as a sandblaster. And they say, well, that's not good for the economy. The scare went off. And I say, that's what the law of products liability should give the user a choice.
On the reasonableness argument, some of the amici say, we just want a rule. Just tell us what the rule is so that we can do it. But don't tell us, well, you'll find out at court something. What's your response to that? How can we give manufacturers or distributors as much objective guidance in this area as possible?
I don't think you can. I mean, I think that both the restatement and OMS says, this turns on the facts of a particular case. Just like you can't tell them what negligence is or not being negligent is. It depends on the facts of the case. And here we have a case where it is undisputed that the intermediary was unsophisticated, subjectively. The head of safety said he didn't really realize that silicosis caused death until 1986. He said twice a day he would walk through the blast house without any protection at all, which all the experts say is extremely accurate. That's the manager of the safety program. I mean, this was a company, the experts said it was the worst conditions ever. There were numerous claims that arose from Spinco's operation in Odessa. So we have a company that is subjectively unreliable and unsophisticated.
This is just an aside, it's not in the briefs, but this is the first warning case like this we've had in 5 or 10 years without any kind of preemption question. But there is none of that. There's no issue that there's a OSHA regulation or some federal requirement that we need to take into account in crafting the common law. Is that right?
I think that's right.
Interesting. It's just an oversight, I guess.
Let me go on to...
If we conclude... Jury question number one doesn't identify who was supposed to get this warning.
Right.
And it just declares that the warning is inadequate.
Right.
If we conclude that under whatever test we apply, the manufacturer is not relieved of getting the warning, they just discharge that duty by reasonably relying on this intermediary. If we find if we conclude that the manufacturer did not give an adequate warning to the employer, is that the end of the inquiry? Is there a liability here, or do we still have to, or do we still measure it against what the user might have known about it, and they should have created the warning?
No, I think he almost conceded at the end that if there was evidence, if the jury had resolved the evidence, the jury resolved the question. As I say, they didn't speculate in question one. Whether the warning of Humble to Spinco was adequate or inadequate. If it was inadequate, I think they lose. I think that was the last question put to counsel. I think he kind of has to admit it. If they give an inadequate warning to Spinco, how can they rely on Spinco to give an accurate warning to its employees? And so I think
I would imagine the answer they're going to give when they stand back up is because it's known in the industry. I mean, that's my understanding of their categorical.
And I would say if they had a better record of what was known in the industry, and their record was clean of all these many violations, everyone's doing it, whether it's out of lightness or lack of knowledge, who knows? I mean, we don't know exactly why they're doing it. But the evidence in this record that everyone's doing it prevents them from saying, well, they all knew of the danger. If a manufacturer knows that they all know of the danger, but many of them are not taking precautions, then I think the restatement, that's a factor that the restatement says, can lead a finder of fact to conclude that the warrant or the jury to conclude that the warning should be given. Let me turn briefly, because it is in the briefs, to several of the points.
But your position today is a little different from the briefs.
Oh, my position whenever I argue a case is different than the briefs. I didn't write the brief. Okay? A lot of the arguments I'm making the brief, I am not making today, intentionally. And one of those, I mean, one of those arguments is their next big point, which is they were entitled to have a jury issue on whether Spencom's, whether Humble's reliance on Spencom was reasonable. And we, of course, cite in our brief the general rule that in determining the duty to warn, that's a question of law for the court. But it is true that this court, this year, in Union Pacific, said where something, there's a fact issue, like foreseeability, disputed fact issue, then the jury ought to resolve that, even though it goes to the existence of the duty. And we respond to that in two ways here. One is that the essential facts were not in dispute in this case concerning the adequacy, that they simply were not in dispute. But more importantly, in Union Pacific, the court said, even if the instruction should be given in one, this court, to reverse, has got to find that it would probably have made a difference. And it did in Union Pacific because, as the court pointed out, the judge in that case instructed the jury that foreseeability has nothing to do with the duty or obligations of the defendant. There was nothing like that in this case. The judge never told the jury, you can't consider the reasonableness of Humble's reliance on Spencom. And if you look at the language to question one, and certainly the negligence question, which doesn't, it could, I mean, the negligence question is wide open. The jury under both questions could have considered the reasonableness of the supplier's reliance on the intermediary. And you've got to say they did, and it resolved it against them. And that's, it's not, even if the instruction should have been normally given, in this case, it was harmless error not to give it. Let me get to two other points that...
Let me ask you this. Do you recognize a distinction between the learned intermediary doctrine and the sophisticated user doctrine? I mean, my understanding was the learned intermediary doctrine involves different issues, and that the position of Mr. Gomez in this case is that the learned intermediary doctrine should never apply in these circumstances, and what we're looking at is sophisticated user.
I don't really understand the difference. Candidly, I don't understand the difference. I mean, to me, it all goes to the same thing. Can you rely on a third party to warn the ultimate user?
Well, it
strikes me. And in some cases, you can because they're a physician.
Well, it strikes me that the learned intermediary, the focus is on the intermediary. Sophisticated user, the focus is on the user of the product.
Okay. I mean, that was... I guess that was what happened in the solder case. They make a big deal out of the solder case because... which didn't involve the intermediary doctrine at all. I mean, there was no intermediary in Sodom. It was just the boilermaker was, the court said that you've got to assume that a boilermaker who's trained would not work on a refinery tower in this manner. It's stupid what he did, removing the cleats and then thinking the thing would not fall. And so you didn't even have an intermediary question in that case. And I mean, they want to kind of cobble together the sophisticated user doctrine with the learned intermediary, and there's no case that I've found that makes that a problem. Before I run out of time, let me just make a few other points or answer if you. They have some evidentiary points about the refusal to admit a petition, which was superseded. Again, this court, that's abuse of discretion standard, and the court needs to affirm if there were any ground on which the court, lower court properly excluded it. We suggest in our brief that one of the grounds was that it was so highly redacted that it was misleading, a 4-2 ground, or 3 ground. And another thing we suggest, and I have handed out to you chart D, is a whole other argument that was not included in the brief, but was derived from commentators and from the Fifth Circuit jurisprudence, that basically says, in a jurisdiction which allows notice and alternative pleading, you can't punish someone by putting in as an evidentiary admission something they say in one count of their pleading to contradict something they say in another count. And that's why it was proper for this court not to allow them to introduce one page of a 35-page pleading claiming negligence on behalf of one of some 24 third parties that were accused in the whole plea. It was just misleading.
Any other questions?
Justice Enick, I am advised that the Oklahoma Supreme Court in the Duane versus Shell case combined the application of these doctrines by holding that there was no duty on the part of a supplier to warn an employer of what the employer already knew in order to convey adequate information to the employee. So that would be the cobbled together case that Mr. Sussman refers to, in which both doctrines have been applied in conjunction. I'm afraid Mr. Sussman and I must have read a different record in this case. He says that there is no evidence, it is undisputed, that there was widespread noncompliance in this industry. Mr. Gomez's witness, former Assistant Secretary of Labor, Eula Bingham, testified that she would have expected employers to be knowledgeable regarding the association between abrasive blasting and silicosis, and to advise and train their employees regarding these hazards.
But was there evidence in the record that employers were not following OSHA regulations regularly? I mean, if
no,
there
Honor.
Is some evidence of that in the record, how can we ignore that?
No, Your Honor. There was a study that predated the OSHA regulations that indicated that among small and mid-sized employers, which Spinco was not, there was a failure to observe proper precautions. There's also a study from England in the 30s or 40s, I want to say.
So you're saying we're not going to find any evidence in this record that...
Of systematic noncompliance in the industry with OSHA regulations? That's correct. In any event, there was very copious evidence. I won't detail all of it, but it's cited in our brief.
What about specific noncompliance? What about the safety manager walking through the blasting room unprotected?
There is no evidence... Well, there is evidence that Spinco was noncompliant, certainly. There's no evidence that Humble knew that. We say that the test is an objective test in any event.
Isn't it your burden to prove that on an affirmative defense? Isn't this an affirmative defense?
No, I don't believe it is, Your Honor. No, I believe it is a measure of our duty.
So you're saying it's the plaintiff's burden, then, to show that you are not a sophisticated user?
That Spinco was not in an industry of sophisticated users. Because that would be...
So we start with the premise of sophistication in every case?
No.
We adopt this doctrine?
When there is an intermediary, then the question is, was there a duty to the ultimate user? The duty test would say no, end of discussion.
So
the restatement and mixed tests would say there is a duty if it is reasonable, if it is not reasonable to rely on the intermediary.
And you argue for a similar reasonableness test as the restatement sets out and as I hear the respondent say.
That's correct, and I agree with Mr. Sussman. I don't know of any way to create bright-line rules in this area unless the court adopts the duty test and just says if there's an intermediary, there's no duty.
So the amici's plea for certainty...
I'm sympathetic to it, and I
falls
wish...
Falls on deaf ears on the bar.
Well, not deaf ears, but ears that are frustrated and don't know how to resolve it.
In the duty question, if I'm the employee of Spinco, and I have the injury, and I want to sue the supplier of the toxic product, and my claim is a failure to warn, you would say that to attach the manufacturer of the product, I have to show that if the manufacturer gave an adequate warning, I would have to show that the manufacturer did not give an adequate warning to the employer, and I would have to show that
or...
Could I get to the manufacturer by simply showing the manufacturer failed to give an adequate warning to my employer? Could I establish the liability by the failure to warn my employer?
Generally in cases, yes. In this case, no.
Now, if I show that there was an adequate warning, if I just take the evidence in this case, and the jury concludes that this warning was not adequate, we'll leave for a moment the argument about how broad that answer is, but the jury determines that the warning is inadequate. Your argument is, but that's not sufficient, because they also have to show that their employer did not otherwise know the information that they say I had failed to warn the employer about in order to prove that the warning was inadequate.
There are two sides of the same coin. Well, yes, they would need to show that the employer didn't already know it, or there would be no causation.
But you're saying that's a causation question. But
right.
You say the duty
if
question.
If the industry already knew it, then the warning was not inadequate because there was no duty to convey that particular information.
Okay. What is your answer briefly to the respondent's argument that question one covers the adequacy of the warning to Spinco as well?
Those were PJC questions, and I think when you look at them, particularly question one, you will see that they are focused on the adequacy of the warning to Gomez. And to say that the warning was inadequate to Gomez without the jury learning that an adequate warning to Spinco could, under the right circumstances, satisfy the supplier's duty is not necessarily a finding that the warning to Spinco was inadequate. The jury could have found the warning...
Well, that answer is, but the jury determines that the warning is inadequate. Your argument is, but that's not sufficient, because they also have to show that their employer did not otherwise know the information that they say I had failed to warn the employer about in order to prove that the warning was inadequate.
There are two sides of the same coin. Well, yes, they would need to show that the employer didn't already know it, or there would be no causation.
Well, you're saying that's a causation question, but
right.
You say the duty
if
question...
If the industry already knew it, then the warning was not inadequate because there was no duty to convey that particular information.
What is your answer briefly to the respondent's argument that question one covers the adequacy of the warning to Spinco as well?
Those were PJC questions, and I think when you look at them, particularly question one, you can see that they are focused on the adequacy of the warning to Gomez. And to say that the warning was inadequate to Gomez without the jury learning that an adequate warning to Spinco could, under the right circumstances, satisfy the supplier's duty is not necessarily a finding that the warning to Spinco was inadequate. The jury could have found the warning to Spinco was adequate, and yet the warning to Gomez not.
Thank you, counsel. That concludes the argument. In the second cause, the court will take another brief recess.
All right.